7BR Part Heard.
Hello and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Eleanor Day, Chambers Paralegal, and this week I'm joined once again by Justin Slater, this time to discuss parental alienation, what it is, how it presents, its impacts, why it's imperative that it's dealt with at an early stage, and what sort of actions the courts can take to address it. Justin practices across the full spectrum of child law, from complex private law disputes, including those cases with a jurisdictional element, such as relocation cases, through to public law matters where the children are separately represented, in wardship, and in issues involving the Hague Convention and Brussels II Revised. His particular expertise lies within public law care and adoption proceedings, where he receives instructions from both public authorities and lay parties. Justin, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Ellie. Good to be back.
Maybe we could start with, what is parental alienation? Is there a definition in law?
There are various definitions, not so much in law, but certainly the law does accept now that, and I think mental health and legal opinion would accept that parental alienation exists. I think you do get a couple of other terms come into play. Frequently, people talk about parental alienation syndrome. Now, technically, the syndrome would be referring specifically to the position taken by the child in unreasonably rejecting a parent who was otherwise a good parent. And, you know, there's lots of sort of anguish about the language here. You know, without a definition, do we know what we're talking about? Well, I think really the experts do know what they're talking about. I think it's one of those points where if it walks like a duck and sounds like a duck, it's a duck. And the experts do understand that parental alienation exists. In terms of a definition of that, I think CAFCAF's best attempt would be where a child's resistance towards one parent is not justified and is the result of psychological manipulation by the other parent. So the key parts there being an unjustified hatred, and that's what it is, it's what it becomes, of the other parent, and the other element being a psychological manipulation. We'll talk about more that as we go on, no doubt, but that's what we're looking at. I think another definition I found, so that's CAFCAS. From the mental health literature, Kelly and Johnston, 2001, would describe an alienated child as being one who expresses freely and persistently unreasonable negative feelings and beliefs such as hatred, anger, rejection, and or fear towards a parent that are significantly disproportionate to the child's actual experience of that parent. So I think that breaks it down quite nicely into really what it is. And I think just on the basic language of what we're looking at, I think we can all understand what we're dealing with. And certainly judges and lawyers alike will understand what the frame of reference is there. So certainly it does exist. Another phrase that's used, and I've seen in some of my research for this podcast, a tendency perhaps to conflate implacable hostility with that as well. I don't say that implacable hostility isn't a sort of a relative of parental alienation, but really implacable hostility in the way that I think it's commonly understood in the family courts is far more open. You have got a parent who is saying no, and I'm not allowing this to happen. I'm not going to progress contact, and is what it says on the tin, openly hostile. And I think the difference between the two is significant because one, it is clear what is going on, but with parental alienation, there is a silence to it, which is undetectable. And I think that gives its particularly pernicious sort of effect on the children.
Mm, that's really interesting. How does it present then? What sort of behaviour indicators are there, either in terms of the parent's behaviour or the child's behaviour?
Well, I think in terms of the child's behaviour, you have, I think the Johnston and Kelly view will assist with that. We have constant denigration of the other parent, a constant siding with the views of the resident parent. Quite often it manifests in extreme ways, such as false allegations of harm, and that harm can take any form. So that's relevant to what we see in the child. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. I think with the parent, it's quite often in my experience been the case that the parent appears like they are open at least to the prospect of contact, but they simply can't make the child go to contact. And I think that's where the manipulation doesn't just extend to the child, it goes to the other adults, family members, lawyers, and eventually the judge, because what that parent is doing is seeking to manipulate everybody around. I think from the child's perspective, it's more a response to a script, as it were, that they feel that their parent needs to have them hold on to. I should say a couple of things in terms of the division between men and women, in terms of who might be an alienating parent. I don't think there's much in it between the two sexes. I think they're both capable of this, and we shouldn't just see it as being something that is perhaps found with women with mothers. I don't think that's right. I think the statistics are about 70% of cases involve mothers, but that's probably more reflective of the fact that there are more sole carers who are mothers. And one point also on the degree of parental alienation. I've seen in the literature referred to mild, moderate and severe parental alienation. And I think my understanding of it is this, is that that isn't a fixed end point. In other words, the child isn't mildly affected by this. That is simply a station along the route, this inevitable route, which will not sort itself out, bar the courts being involved and making changes in that child's life. So really, when you're looking at mild, moderate or severe types of parental alienation, it's just really a question of time and a question of age. And the age of the child, forgive me if I'm getting carried away, but the age of the child, it seems to me, is quite relevant here, because you don't often see in material about parental alienation any breakdown on the numbers who are suffering from this according to their age. And I think from what I've been able to glean from the literature, it is quite unusual in the sort of under sevens, under eights. And that's possibly for a number of reasons. They are, in other words, this sort of hardened, demonized view of the other parent is very rarely seen in much younger children than that. One of the reasons, and I thought this was rather charming in a way, was that they tend to let go of their anger easier. In other words, the parent may be able to build them up to a point where they're angry at the other parent, but they soon forget about it. They go off and do other things. They tend to forget the script. And that's particularly important when they're meeting with an expert who will speak to them about their experiences of the other parent. They're far more easily inconsistent in what they say. They have many other sort of ways in which you can imagine that they are less likely to take sides. I think the only caveat to that is where you get younger children who have adjustment presentation difficulties. In other words, if they're particularly anxious children, they may be more susceptible to parental alienation, even at a young age, because the whole process of going through this conflict, this on-running conflict, this ongoing conflict, which is played out in the family and it's played out in court, however long the proceedings are, you get a child who has less resilience, is more likely to align herself with a parent to simply seek relief from it, if that follows. So you do get that impact mm-hmm. in younger children. It's slightly more prevalent in adolescents because they are of an age where loyalty is very much a factor in their lives. They have that rebellious sort of programming in them, and that can lead to a rejection that can take the form of enabling them to reject an otherwise capable parent. They're capable of taking a sort of more moral, angry stance against the other parent. Other issues that can impact the ages that we're dealing with are whether or not there's supervised contact. You can imagine if a child is told that a parent is dangerous or harmful, and then the courts say, well, we'll have supervised contact. The child then goes into a situation of supervised contact, and it sort of feeds this false narrative about the danger that's presented by the other parent.
And what sort of impact does that have on a child if it were to get
too far down that route as you described?
Well, the impact is hugely significant. I remember not that long ago being involved in a case, and I read the expert report, because more often than not, you'll have a child and adolescent psychiatrist or some expert to assist. And I remember reading that, and it was put in very stark terms, and rightly so, that this is child abuse. We have to remember that. It doesn't always lend itself to that sort of understanding at first blush, because you have a child who, in many respects, is otherwise very well looked after. You know, we could be talking about families, and we often are, I'm afraid, talking about families of relatively affluent, socially adjusted on the face of it families. A child will be going to school, won't seem to be neglected. I mean, one of the interesting elements of this is that I do a lot of public law work, so work within care proceedings, and I don't think I've ever come across a case of parental alienation in the public law arena where all antenna are focused on child abuse. We don't get that. We only ever get this in the private law arena. And I think that does in itself give some hesitancy to courts in terms of really grasping that nettle at an early stage and dealing with matters. But the harm that's done early is significant. And you have to think of it as being like a constellation of harm that you put together and you see what impact it has in totality. I mean, the first and most obvious is maybe a loss of a relationship with the other parent. That has already happened. Even if they're seeing the other parent, they're emotionally separated from that parent. And it's very often the case that courts can't patch it up. There's nothing that can be done. There are many cases, even recent cases, where courts have felt that it's just too far along the line and we can't do anything now to forcibly fix that relationship. It just needs time to play out. But you also get the loss of that parent's family, the paternal side of the family or the maternal side of the family. That's all lost. You very often see children who take adverse views on not only that parent, but also friends and relatives of that parent. You get false allegations are made, which can have serious criminal impacts on the other parent. You also get the sort of loss of autonomy of the child. The child is learning not to think for itself, not to build relationships for itself. Children who are alienated from another parent quite often have trust issues, because the narrative that they're fed by the alienating parent doesn't fit with their experiences of the other parent. And so you get this mishmash. Things don't add up in the mind of the child. And so then the child is forced always to think, well, who do I trust? Which way is north in my life? It must be my mum or my dad, whoever the alienating parent is. And that leads to a very unhealthy codependent type relationship. You get trust issues, you get issues with authority in the future, because only the authority of the mother or whoever was alienating is relevant. You get a psychological phenomenon I think I've seen referred to as splitting, where the child sees everything, for example, about the alienating parents, for example, the mother, everything there is positive, everything there is good and trustworthy, and everything the other side of the family is negative. You often get illness-type behaviours, thinking that you've been harmed, thinking that you're not safe. You only have to say that out loud to see how, in the development of a young child, that could lead to really very significant psychological problems down the line. And we do see that. I think where ordinarily, I think about between 5 and 15, so call it 10% of us might suffer from some form of clinical depression. I think with parentally alienated children, that rises to about 70%. You get a very much higher incidence of drug and alcohol misuse. And you also get all the other now accepted difficulties of children who grow up only knowing one parent. So all of that feeds in. You see, it's not just one issue. All of that feeds in to the damage and the harm that's done to a child. And that is why, you know, the experts, those who know their business, stand up. And I'm afraid they do have to be brave in a world where there is a lot of criticism out there of experts who dare deal with this sort of material. They have to stand up and be brave and call it when they see it, because it's this sort of silent type of abuse. It's not obvious, because in every other respect, the child may be very well cared for. It also goes on to the point about what courts do with these things when they've found it, because by definition, if you accept what I've told you, you have met the criteria, what we call in public law work, the threshold criteria. So that's like a sort of an imaginary line in the sand, as it were. I mean, all families have their problems. All families have their positives as well. But if you cross the line, the threshold line, that justifies state involvement. So where you've got parental alienation, you have by definition, I think, got interim threshold at least for public law orders, so possibly care orders to be made. I think the reason why they're often not made, though, Ellie, is because on the other side of the equation, you've actually got a parent who can care. I mean, that isn't always the case, but the absent parent is usually capable of caring. I think you do sometimes, though, need public law orders, such as supervision orders, just so social workers can come in and effect a sensible transition from one parent's care to the other.
So what sort of evidence do we have about the court's views on parental alienation, and how do they deal with it most often?
Well, I think I could only say anecdotally, in terms of what the court's responses are. And I think a little bit like coercive control and domestic abuse, the courts, I think, are probably slightly ahead of practitioners in this field. The courts understand, and CAFCAS now understands, and they have their own checklist, which it will run through when it starts with the case. And I think that the key to it is that courts should now understand, and I think do, that you need to take action quite quickly. So in other words, what that action looks like at the start is the commissioning of an expert report. That isn't always easy for funding reasons, but the commissioning of an expert report, I think then what can be too slow to the party is the allocation of a 16-4 guardian. So in other words, a guardian and a lawyer to represent the interests of the child. And then I think you need to get it listed for a fact find.
Right.
And those are, I think, the key quick and initial responses that a court will have in relation to trying to navigate its way through a case where parental alienation is at least a very likely element of the case.
And what is the role of expert then? It sounds like pretty central, and it's quite specialist.
Yes, I think that's right, Ellie. I think you would be hard pressed and making an error if you were to advise a way through without an expert. I think that might be tempting if you were representing an accused alienator, but certainly I think even then you may be in difficulties. They are absolutely key to the court understanding really what is going on behind the scenes. And I'm reminded from the Cleveland report, Dame Butler Sloss's words, that children aren't simply an object of concern in these sorts of proceedings. They're actually an actor in their own right. So how that's relevant, Ellie, is this. You'll quite often get cases where allegations have been made by the child, and the court has to work out whether or not those allegations are true. And what is sometimes invoked is perhaps a re-W application for the child to give evidence. Now, if the child's of that age, that is an application that might be made. But it should not be made, I think, because the whole court process itself is part of the battlefield that this child is experiencing. And when I say that a child is an actor within these proceedings, that's nowhere more relevant, I think, than in parental alienation, because the court has to achieve a knowledge of the ascertainable wishes and feelings of the child, not the expressed wishes and feelings of the child. So the difference there, of course, is an alienated child will express what it is told to express. Those will be the wishes and feelings. That's what you'll get in evidence. That's why I think you don't need evidence. Plus, you have the damage which is done by standing up in the witness box or however it's done and saying that my father or my mother is, you know, X, Y, and Z, which could have a profound effect on the child. So what the expert will do, and I think rather than the guardian, if you have both, but what the expert will do is to run through with the child, and permission ought to be sought for the expert, of course, to see the child. That's quite often forgotten in orders. But so the expert can run through what some of the evidence is and why the child holds some of the feelings it does, because they're the ones with the ability to really gently test what's being said, to detect whether or not there's a script being adhered to by the child, to see whether or not the memories, I mean, very often they come undone because the memories aren't true memories. One unusual element about a fact-finding where you've got parental alienation is that if you're trying to establish parental alienation, as perhaps the absent parent might be doing, they have to do that with an inquiry into the allegations made against them. And that is sort of slightly a difficult way of playing things through, but that's the way it has to be, because it's only by looking at the veracity of what's said against them and whether a child's views on and recalled memory of what's happened can have any basis in fact that you can then see that, in fact, it hasn't come from the child, it's come from a parent.
Right.
It's not been experienced. Negative parenting hasn't been experienced. It's been put there by this mental manipulation by the absent parent. Of course, there are some times where, you know, the other parents behave terribly. And the experts, you know, in my experience, the sort of experts that are involved in this field are slow to say there's been parental alienation. And even where they say there's parental alienation, they are very often slow to say there should be a change in residence. So it's a complex picture and it's very difficult for the courts. But I think the speed with which the courts can deal with matters is critical. I think judicial continuity is critical. And I know some have called for specialist courts to be set up, much like the sort of family drug and alcohol courts that we have that actually would deal with these sorts of cases. But going back to something I touched on earlier, I think the tendency which is ordinarily there, where you've got two well-meaning parents who can't quite see eye to eye and the contact isn't squared away, is to give more time, is to do things bit by bit, to go at the child's pace, the sort of language we hear a lot of. But with parental alienation, you've got a child that's being abused, okay? And it's not going to get better, okay? It's points, it's stations along the line. It's not, you don't stop at a low impact on the child. You have to make a change. And I think in terms of outcomes here, it is often said that, you know, this draconian step that could be taken to change the residence or to change the living arrangements for the child. And I think wise heads would point out that it maybe isn't that draconian. They are going to another parent. They're not going into foster care. They're not being adopted. That's the truly draconian measures that the court has jurisdiction for and has powers for. But what we're talking about is another family placement. But I think ordinarily, before you get to that point, many years ago, we introduced the idea of these suspended residence orders. So when we still had residence orders, there'd be suspended child arrangements orders now. And that is a critical way out of this, because slowly, slowly approach doesn't work. Therapy, well, that's fine if people want to go off and do it by themselves, but that's not within the gift of the court. And that isn't the function of the court. The function of the court is to use what's in its armory to stop the abuse of a child. So very often what you'll see is a prescriptive order saying what contact there should be, saying what must and mustn't be said to the child by way of derogatory comments or by way of encouragement for contact, having third parties involved in making that contact happen. And this is where you cannot allow for deviation. You cannot allow for an alienating parent to come back to either the CAFCAS officer or the court and say, well, look, you know, he didn't turn up. I got this message. I'm not going to allow contact for this reason. If the court has found parental alienation, bar other issues, if it is that issue of primacy in the case, then you have to stick to that. And there has to be a mechanism, in my view, whereby if that is lost, if that road to home, as it were, is deviated from, and they will seek to deviate from it, because that is the function, as it were, of the alienating parent. They're not going to get better at doing this or not doing it. They're going to keep alienating. The only way out of that is to let the child experience the other parent. Because what children do is they will then test what they've been told with the reality of their own observations. And if they're young enough and if they're exposed enough to the reality, they can start to correct that issue. But if there are issues with that, that's why the suspended order is good, because if it's breached or if we find ourselves on rocky road in terms of compliance with the order, then the other parent knows that there will be a swift change of residence. I think exposure to the other parent is important. It's one of those areas where quantity has its own quality. It actually does something, I think, by having that exposure to the other parent, rather than just doing it perhaps in one wholesale move. But, you know, sometimes the wholesale move does need to be made.
I found it really interesting that you mentioned the importance of parental alienation being caught early and how that's a bit out of step with conventional practice in the family courts. And I've also read about how quite common court orders like indirect contact arrangements can sometimes mask the issue because they seem to be working well, but actually behind the scenes, the child is being manipulated. So I wondered, firstly, whether you think it's the case that the family court system itself creates barriers to identifying and addressing parental alienation? And secondly, if so, what practitioners can do to be alive to some of these concerns?
Well, I mean, I think that's right. And it's easy to be critical of the court process, I think, in sort of two ways. I think fundamentally, it's another battleground. And it's one where the child is equally as involved as they are at home on that battleground. And I think it's one of those areas where you just need to know what you're dealing with. And I think practitioners need to take clear instructions, and they need to, not just practitioners, but professionals such as CAFCAS, you know, they are trained in these areas. They'll be looking out for very strongly held views of a child. I mean, you know, because that'll be part of the alienating parent's case. And I think it's a question of simply getting the act together as soon as possible to make the process as speedy as possible. And, you know, we do have examples. I think Parker J, you know, changing the living arrangements for a child on an interim basis because she followed the evidence. You know, material comes in front of her, there's an expert report. Well, you know, I'm following the evidence. I'm going to do what is I'm told to do. I think, you know, we need to step away from this reluctance to act because, well, you know, what really is the harm? And the CAFCAS aren't too sure about it. If you've got an expert saying this child is being harmed, obviously you need to act. I think the other way in which courts are quite easily criticised, and no one can blame them, I think, for this, is that they're just simply overworked. I think, you know, I'd say particularly nowadays, but, you know, the idea of starting proceedings as an absent parent where your child's being alienated and thinking that you're going to have a CAFCAS officer swiftly appointed who sees what could be going on and who pushes the court for an early expert view. You then have judicial continuity and come before a robust court who either sets out a very prescriptive set of contact arrangements or who simply at that point makes a change in the child's living arrangements. These things just don't happen. And that's why I think practitioners are beginning to talk about whether or not specific courts need to be set up. You know, where you get, as we do in these fabulous FDAC courts, experts running with the case, as it were, with judicial continuity coming back on a regular basis. And we see, you know, but that's the gold standard, isn't it? That's what we all want to achieve. I think as a practitioner, though, you need to be aware from first conference that if these issues are likely to be raised, you have to push and push hard for this to be done, because I'm afraid in those early stages, it will be very easy for the other side to slow matters down and to suggest, as you just did, you know, perhaps indirect contact or the reasonable approach of, or perhaps we can do this or that, to really throw the hounds off the scent. But I think that is something where I think experience comes into play. And we very much hope now that Kafkas are more alive to it than perhaps has been the case in years previously.
It definitely does seem that things are moving in the right direction.
Yes, I mean, I think so, Ellie. I mean, I hope people listen to, you know, these sorts of podcasts and read some of the case law on it. It's factually very complex, but it's incredibly important that people are aware of it, because as we outlined earlier, this is child abuse. You know, we work in the family courts, we work with children, and we are trained to look and to know and to understand abusive behaviours. I think this is one of those areas where it sort of goes under the radar. It goes under the radar for a number of reasons. I mean, you know, perhaps you may not even accept what your own client is saying initially in terms of the unreasonableness, because it's difficult to understand exactly the depth of feeling and what's going on in the family if you only have a short amount of time with your client. I mean, you know, and more so now with remote hearings, when, you know, you're not even seeing your client face to face, either solicitors or counsel. So there are real problems here. But the more we talk about it, because there is a legal and mental health consensus that parental alienation exists, I don't think we should get hung up on the language, whether it's, you know, a mental disorder or a diagnosable syndrome. I think that can run its course, and it will run its course. But the fact is, the experts know what it is, they know what they're looking for, and the courts know what it is and know what they're looking for. And we know it amounts to abusive behaviour.
And hopefully now our listeners have a better idea as well. So thank you, Justin.
Hopefully they do. Thank you, Ellie.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of 7BR's Part Heard. For more information and to listen to all of our previous episodes, including my previous conversation with Justin on domestic abuse in private law children cases, which includes Dr. Adrienne Barnett, please visit our website.